I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, Namwali Sirpel on her epic debut novel, The Old Drift. Namwali Sirpel is a Zambian writer who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley. She received a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award for Women Writers in 2011 and was selected for the Africa 39, a 2014 Hay Festival project to identify the best African writers under 40. She won the 2015 Kane Prize for African Writing, and The Old Drift, which we're going to be talking about today, is her first novel. Namwali, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First of all, how would you describe the novel?
So for a long time, I've been describing the novel with a bit of a tongue-in-cheek phrase, which is the great Zambian novel you didn't know you were waiting for. And that originated when I started writing this in college, and me and my friends would joke about the idea of a novel, an epic-sized, you know, great saga about a very small country, which is where I'm from.
The book tells a multi-generational story of some linked families, and we're going to talk about some of those characters as we go. But, you know, fundamentally also, it's a story of the founding of the nation of Zambia.
Yeah.
Tell us something about the founding of the nation of Zambia, but also how you wanted to represent that in the novel, I guess.
Yeah, so I wanted to tell the story of my country through a kind of sideways view, a kind of glance at history passing as told through the eyes of a series of characters who are connected, as you say, through family connections, but also in what I like to call a cycle of unwitting retribution. So the novel starts at an early colonial settlement called the Old Drift, which is on the banks of the Zambezi River. And there, three men get entangled in a kind of accident. All three of them are historical figures. One of them is a Brit named Percy Clark. One of them is an Italian hotelier named Pietro Cabuzzi. And one of them is a Tonga busboy named Ngulube. And they kind of collide in this one moment in a feverish night in the early Victoria Falls hotel dining room at the turn of the 20th century, 1904, 1905 or so. And this sets off a kind of metaphysical relationship between their three families. I then proceed to follow those three families over the course of three major generations, the grandmothers, the mothers, and the children. And over the course of the 20th century, as Zambia comes into being as a nation from its earliest days as a colonial protectorate called Northern Rhodesia, and into a near future Zambia of the 21st century. So the novel ends in 2023 or so.
Again, before we get into the place and the characters, the other thing I wanted to talk about is the book has numerous narrators as we go through the story, but one of them, or many of them, I should say, there is a chorus of a swarm of mosquitoes that comments on the story as well, which is a fantastic device and something that's going to come up again when we get to the end of the interview. But tell me why you use that device.
So the idea of having a narrator come in every once in a while to comment on the story, to tell little pieces of Zambian history, to kind of nerd out about philology and etymology and science and geography and history. That idea was there from the very start. As I said, I was writing the novel since I was about 20. And so I started writing in this very grand voice that was very omniscient, knew a lot about these three families, and knew a lot about the country as it was coming into being. And at a certain point, I realized that the character that I had planned as a body for that voice was too small. He wasn't capacious enough, and I didn't know enough about him. So I'd had the thought that it would be the final descendant of these three families, because the last generation ends up in a bit of a love triangle, and there's a child of uncertain paternity. And I thought, well, okay, that son will be the person narrating this entire story, and he's searching for his roots. But then I realized that he knew too much as a single human. And I also realized that I didn't know enough about him because he exists in the future. And so I didn't want to have to kind of conceive of an entire new environment for him. I also didn't know which of the two characters was really his father. And I felt that that was pretty important in deciding what kind of a person he was. So I just, at some point, I think quite late in the process, I was thinking about this voice that was tying all of these elements of the plot together. And I think because I had chosen to begin the novel in a swamp, where this colonial settlement, where by the end of it, most of the people there had died of malaria, there was a sort of kind of persistent theme running through my mind, which had to do with viruses and transmission and contagion. I read a review of Seamus Heaney's translation of Virgil's Aeneid, and it quoted a passage that ended up being the epigraph to the book, in which he describes a kind of numerous spirits, a kind of hovering multitude, humming with life by the banks of a river. And suddenly it just all came together, and all of the different pieces of the novel, including the science fictional aspects of the novel, which had diverted into a consideration of drones and HIV/AIDS vaccines, and it all just kind of came together, and I decided, oh, it's a swarm of mosquitoes.
Well, indeed, we could perhaps mention that now, that at the end of the book there is a swarm of not just drones but mini drones, like micro drones, which obviously is redolent of a swarm of mosquitoes.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that those plot elements came together at a certain point. And yeah, all of these different filaments, all of these different themes, just one day all just coincided. I remember where I was, and I remember thinking through each of the individual aspects of it and feeling very excited and writing to both of my editors. The book had already been sold by then, and saying, here's this thing I want to try. I know it sounds a bit crazy, but I'm really excited by it. And writing those parts of the novel, that was some of the most exciting writing that I did for myself.
So some of the characters in the book are real people, based on real people, if fictionalized slightly. And Percy Clarke is one of those, isn't he?
Yes. He wrote a book called The Autobiography of an Old Drifter. And I landed on him, I kind of discovered him when I was doing research about the Old Drift as a colonial settlement. So I was with a friend of mine, and we were at a game park near the Victoria Falls, and the Land Rover pulled over and our guide got out and he said, this is the Old Drift Cemetery. And it's this small little grove of kind of tumble down gravestones. And it's the last trace of the settlement of people, which at its peak was maybe 100 or 200 people at its most numerous. And so when I was researching old drift, which it struck me a remarkable word, it turns out a drift is a relatively common word in geography to describe the deepest and stillest part of a river where you can drift things across. And so it was a sort of outpost where people were crossing the river from the south into the north. And I discovered this autobiography, this memoir written by this man, Percy Clark. And as I read it, I thought, I found him very charming. He's this kind of working class British man who grew up in Cambridgeshire and tried to make his way into the university kind of sideways, working as a lab assistant in a chemistry lab, and then got booted out under kind of shady circumstances, and then decided to make his way to Africa to kind of make his fortune. And I found him very funny and charming and interesting. And then once he got to Africa, it was really disconcerting to read these kind of awful words and phrases that he would use to describe the native people that he encountered there. Just really dismissive, derogatory terms. And I wanted to capture that shock that I had felt in reading his work. And I decided the best way to do that really was to use his own words and to kind of build the narrative around him and these two other historical figures that he mentions in his memoir, Gavuzzi, the Italian hotelier, about whom I was able to learn a bit more by doing some research about the Piedmontese Italians who came to Africa. And then this man Ngulube, who I had no information to go on at all, and so had to build entirely from scratch.
I wanted to talk to you about writing the character of Percy Clark, because, I mean, you said, you know, to begin with, you were charmed, but he's a brute and a monster.
Yeah.
And I wondered what that was like to actually live with him for that period of time.
Well, it was the novel, as you said, has several, you know, narrators. Technically, the only first-person narrator of the characters, apart from the plural we of the mosquitoes, is Percy. It's mm-hmm. his first-person voice. Everybody else is sort of focalized in the third person. So I'm with them, but there is a kind of narrator who is telling the story. But Percy, I left his words alone. And I think that as a literature professor myself, I'm quite used to reading novels and nonfiction from the historical past that are incredibly racist and sexist and demeaning.
Yeah, so I teach American literature, so that's
exactly. And the last chapter of my novel engages quite deeply with Heart of Darkness. So, you know, there's a way in which it was not incredibly difficult for me to read Percy, but I did feel that shock of seeing him use the N-word or the K and the K-word, kafir, in his prose with this just kind of blitheness. And his book was published in, I think, 1925 or maybe even 1935. So there's a sense in which, you know, he was still thinking in those terms way past the colonial moment. And I wanted to capture a little bit of that heartache that I felt. Also because my experience growing up in Zambia as a mixed-race Zambian person was to be around white Europeans who had chosen to migrate to Zambia. And so some of my characters, like Sibilla, who's an Italian woman who moves and stays, like Percy's granddaughter Agnes, who's a British woman who moves and stays, I was surrounded by a very different sort of, you know, white person from Europe coming to Africa. And so reading this early incursion of this kind of person was quite disillusioning, I'll say, rather than disturbing.
Give us a taste of what the old drift, the settlement, would have been like at that time. You know, Percy describes like a very stratified society, even, you know, beyond the fact that there are Europeans and indigenous people, because the Europeans, like, clearly he looks down on the Italian, and yeah. He mentions a Jewish person at one point who he doesn't like, and then there are what he describes as Arabs and coloureds, who are the people that are like the servants. And only then do you get to the indigenous people.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's very much how the description of that place, and of course, all the descriptions that we have are from the Europeans that went, including French and Italian missionaries who also settled in that part of the world. So who felt very similarly to Percy about indigenous Africans, but would phrase their condescension in more, say, paternalistic terms. But yeah, there's very much a kind of stratification built in. What was interesting for me to read in Percy's narrative is that because he comes from a very socially and class stratified society in England, he has way more power in Africa than he ever did in England. And there's a part where he goes back to England to get married and bring his wife. And the way that people treat him there sort of shocks him back into how he grew up. He grew up very poor. So I found it very interesting to think about the way that these class and race structures kind of intersect, and they kind of get all jumbled up in the African context, especially at that time when things are still so amorphous. There really aren't any boundaries or borders or nations to be had at that point.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Listed to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Namwali Serpell, and we're talking about her debut novel, The Old Drift. And Namwali, I wanted to talk about some of the other characters, a couple of the other characters that feature in the book. Before we do, as you said, the book begins with Percy and then goes on to be set out in generational terms. So there's chapters based around grandmothers, mothers and daughters, and as anybody just hearing me describe that will notice, these are all set out on the matrilineal line, and I just wanted to talk about that decision.
Yes, although I will note that you've made a slight error, as many people do, in describing the last chapters as the daughters when it's actually the children. Because it's actually two men and a woman in that last love triangle, which I find
it is Joseph and Jacob. You're right. Yeah,
exactly. But a lot of people make that mistake. Like I don't fault you at all. And I think it's a telling mistake that people make, because I think it suggests the weight of female experience in the novel.
Indeed.
even though my intention, as set out, you know, in terms of actual numbers, in the characters, and was not necessarily to write a matrilineal family story like, say, the Joy Luck Club. There are lots of other references that I could point to where the majority of the characters are women, or the majority of the characters are men. I wasn't really thinking in those terms when I started writing the book. I actually think it's my own flaw as a young writer, which was just that female experience was more accessible to me. So when I was mapping the novel out, there was no point where I changed a character to become a woman or to become a man instead, or choose to go from a man's perspective, choose to go from a woman's perspective. These were just the characters that came to me as they did. So, for example, the families, even though the novel is structured in terms of generations, each of the individual families came to me in their multi-generational pack. So the first family that came to me was Martha Mwamba, Sylvia, her daughter, and Jacob, Sylvia's son and Martha's grandson. My sense of the gender balance is more retrospective, looking back at myself as a young writer, than something I can really make a claim to have done intentionally.
I want to talk about Martha, and particularly again another real life character that she basically encounters and becomes involved in. That's Edward, is it Malula?
It's Mukuka Nkolosi.
Mukuka. I couldn't tell whether that, my writing's so bad, I couldn't tell whether that was an L or a K. Edward
Mukuka
Nkolosi.
Yeah.
Who, a real life character who basically was behind the Zambian space program. So yes. I wanted to talk about that strand of the story.
Yeah, so I learned about Nkoloso relatively late in the process. I was writing the book off and on, and I had this character of Martha. She had a different name then. She's also a historical figure, her name. And I stuck to the facts that I knew about her young life, and then diverged basically when she becomes a young woman and is kicked out of the space program. So the space program was Nkoloso's attempt to join the space race right on the eve of Zambia's becoming a nation, becoming an independent nation in 1964. And so the first Time magazine article about our independence celebration had as its last paragraph a description of what it called a school teacher named Nkoloso, who is training some young men and women and one woman to go to the moon. Martha Mwamba is a, quote, curvaceous 16-year-old who is raising 12 cats to take with her to Mars to be released one by one to make sure that it's habitable. Nkoloso says that he's also training his cadets to walk on their hands, which is the only way that one can transverse the moon. He was swinging them from ropes, from trees, and rolling them downhill in empty oil barrels to simulate anti-gravity conditions. And so this was sort of like this kind of footnote to what otherwise was supposed to be this great political triumph, this kind of birth of a new nation out of colonialism. And, you know, reporters from all over the world, from Canada, from Germany, from England, from America, came to interview Nkoloso and to film him. So you can actually see footage of his do-it-yourself training techniques on YouTube now, if you Google his name. And I came to him to this story through the work of a Spanish photographer named Cristina de Medel, who made an exhibition called Afronauts, where she was sort of kind of riffing on the fact that this had happened. The photographs were taken, I think, in Spain, not in Zambia. And it's sort of a kind of speculative, dreamy, hipstery picture of what the space program looked like. And I got very excited to see that a short film called Afronauts by Francis Perdomo, a Ghanaian-American filmmaker, had done really well and is in black and white. And she had picked up the story of Martha Mwamba as well. And so I decided, I wrote a piece about the space program, having done some archival research on Nkoloso himself and done some interviews back in Zambia. So I wrote a nonfiction article about the space program in the New Yorker. And then I decided to try to fictionalize at least part of what the space program was, and to kind of posit my own theory as to what Nkoloso was trying to do.
Martha, she basically ends up, obviously we know they didn't go into space, but you know, she also becomes pregnant and ends up having to sort of leave. And then, you know, what she does is she weeps. That's a characteristic of Martha. She weeps a lot. And and one of the other characters that you mentioned earlier, Sibylla, the Italian, is born covered in hair. And I wanted to talk about incorporating these sort of elements. Like, I've seen the book described elsewhere as, you know, incorporating elements of magical realism and stuff. And I just wanted to talk about incorporating these elements in it.
Yeah. So, you know, with Martha, you know, she historically, the person was kicked out of the program for getting pregnant. And Nkoloso blamed that incident for why the space program fell apart. And so when I had learned about the space program, and that one fact of how it ended happened to coincide with this character that I had already conceived as a woman in her teenage years, 16, 17, who was pregnant and was abandoned by her lover, and who begins to cry all the time. So that figure and that moment of heartbreak and being left with this baby and crying for decades and decades, I think is the first thing I wrote of this novel in about the year 2000. So it was this kind of strange combination of a real historical figure who was involved in this strange Afrofuturist, almost science fictional adventure with this magical realist character that I had conceived very early on. I was very obsessed with magical realism when I was a student. I was reading a lot of Marquez and Rushdie. I would even characterize some Nabokov as magical realist, Toni Morrison, Maria Luisa Bombal. And so that influence was very strong. And I've been thinking more and more as people ask me this question, what about magical realism appealed to me? And I think you can see it in the specific kind of magic that I get interested in depicting, which is to say there's magical realism that's about the environment, that's about creatures or beasts or, you know, plants, that sort of natural nature, magical realism. And mine is much more focused on the body and very specifically on the surface of the body and where it interfaces between the inside and the outside of you. So the skin, the eyes, tears, hair, all of these kind of aspects of the human body, and specifically, I guess, the female body in the book, that I was interested in exaggerating or intensifying. And I'm also very interested in like what this has to do with how we perceive ourselves in terms of beauty. So one thing about Sibylla is, even though she's covered in hair, which grows continually from her body, no matter how fast she tries to trim it, and there's a kind of fairy tale element there of Rapunzel that I'm playing off of, she's considered very beautiful. And her daughter, in fact, is obsessed with the fact that her mother, even though she has this feature that you would normally think would be grotesque or monstrous, is actually quite beautiful. And the same with Martha, where I wanted the tears, which are considered this kind of feature of femininity, of sorrow, of the pietà, of this idea of Mama Africa crying for her children, and to make that turn into this kind of biological nightmare. Because if you're crying all the time, you're not going to be able to see, your skin's going to become a certain kind of way, you're going to get salty and cracked. And so I wanted to kind of exaggerate these things in different directions to see what would come of them. But I'm interested in other genres as well, which is why the novel in many ways is inspired by something like Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell, where I'm moving through magical realism, social realism, historical fiction, and by the end of the novel, we're in science fiction.
Just to finish it off then, can I get you to read us a little bit?
Yes, sure. So I'll just read from the very beginning of the novel, which is from the perspective of the mosquitoes, and tells one kind of origin story about the creation of Zambia. Zona. And so, a dead white man grows bearded and lost in the blinding heart of Africa. With his rooting and roving, his stops and starts, he becomes our father unwitting, our inadvertent pater Muzungu. This is the story of a nation, not a kingdom or a people. So it begins, of course, with a white man. Once upon a time, a goodly Scottish doctor caught a notion to find the source of the Nile. He found instead a gash in the ground full of massed, tumbling water. His bearers called it Mosiotunya, which means the smoke that thunders, but he gave it the name of his queen, Victoria Falls. He described the falls with a stately awe, comparing the flung water to British things, to fleece and snow and the sparks from burning steel, to myriads of small comets rushing on in one direction, each of which left behind its nucleus rays of foam. He speculated that angels had gazed down upon it and said to each other, "How lovely." He even opined, like a set designer, that there really ought to be mountains in the backdrop. Adventure, disaster, fame, commerce, Christianity, civilization. He was mauled by a lion that shook him in its jaws, he said, as a dog shakes a rat. His wife died of fever. His beloved poodle drowned. He voyaged over land and along endless waterways. He freed slaves as he went, broke their chains with his very hands, and took them on as his servants and bearers. Late in his life, he witnessed a massacre, slave traders shooting at people in a lake, so many the canoes could not pass. He despaired. He was broken, broke. Queen Victoria had forgotten him. The royal geographers said he was dead. Then a mercenary Welsh bastard named Stanley presumed, shook his hand, and sent word to London. And in an instant, he was infamous, as if risen from the grave. Yet he refused to return to merry England. Doddering, he drove deeper into the continent instead, still seeking his beloved Nile. O Father Muzungu, the word means white man, but it describes not the skin, but a tendency. A Muzungu is one who will zunguluka, wander aimlessly, until they end up in circles. And so our Muvius Muzungu pitched up here again, dragging his black bearers with him. His medicine box went missing. Who took it? They never found out. And with it, his precious quinine. Fever hunted him and finally caught him. He died in a hut in the night on his bed, kneeling, his head in his hands. His men disemboweled him, planted his heart under a tree, and bore his corpse to the coast. A ship called the HMS Vulture took his body home. What was left without the living was buried under stone in the nave of Westminster Abbey. His people had recognized him by the scrapes of the lion's teeth on his humerus bone. Such wonder at the resolve of his bearers, to travel with a corpse for months on end, suffering loss and injury, sickness and battle, through blistering heat and blundering rain, beating off the taboo that to carry death is to beckon it, to come all the way to England, to face interrogation, to build a model of the hut that he died in. What faith, what love, no, what fear. That corpse, that body was proof. Without it, who would have possibly have taken their word that a white man among so-called savages had died of bad luck, a mere fever? Men never believe chance can reap great consequence. Yet the story of this place is full of such slips. Error, noun, from the Latin, errare, to stray, or to veer, or to wander. For instance, the Wazungu who carved this territory into a colony, then a protectorate, then a federation, then a country, came here only because Livingston did. They drifted in and settled the land. They drew their arbitrary lines in the sand. They stole treaties from chiefs with a devious ruse, a royal charter meant for business but used for state. Waving flags and guns and beads to trade with, they scrambled rabid for Africa and claimed it was Livingston's legacy. Neither Oriental nor Occidental, but accidental is this nation. Would you believe our godly Scotch doc was searching for the Nile in the wrong spot? As it turns out, there are two Niles, one blue, one white, which means two sources. Neither one of them is anywhere near here. This sort of thing happens with nations and tales and humans and signs. You go hunting for a source, some original word or symbol, and suddenly the path splits, cleaved by apostrophe or dash. The tongue forks, speaks in two ways, which in turn fork and fork into a chaos of capillarity. Where you sought an origin, you find a vast babble, which is also a silence, a chasm of smoke, thundering, blind mouth.
So I've been talking to Namwali Serpo. We've been talking about her debut novel, The Old Drift, which is out now in the UK from Hogarth Books. Namwali, thank you so much for sharing it with me.
Thank you so much.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.